Let's see, I just pressed record. So it is July 29th, 2017, Shabbat morning. It's a little humid, but it's not as hot as it has been. And we pray for more respite and the heat, because it has been a warm summer. This morning, we are 2 days away from Tisha B'Av. And what is read in the synagogue at this time, Tisha B'Av, is Echa, or Lamentations, in the Christian Bible. And anyone, Tisha B'Av, what are things that happen? What's this commemoration about?
It's the destruction, the destructions of each temple.
Yep. So its main focus is the destructions of the temples. And what, in Jewish tradition, it even goes beyond that. It's really not just that, it's
also the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492. And the most memorable recently was the expulsion of the Jews from Gush-Katif 11 years ago.
Tisha B'Av almost is kind of has the same power in English as Friday the 13th, where like anything that's ever bad happens on this day in Jewish history. It's supposed to start with the 10 spies that are expelled from that go into Canaan and then say, no, we can't do it. The destruction of the two temples, and then the Romans during the time of Bar Kokhba is also related to Tisha B'Av, and so on. So it's kind of this idea of remembering. It's a day of mourning is the basic idea. Anything that's ever bad that's happened, you kind of remember it, which is ironic.
Day of mourning and a day of fasting.
Day of mourning and day of fasting. And it's actually for 25 hours in length. It's more than 24. And again, Tisha is the ninth of Av, and it's usually in the summer. And often Sharon and my anniversary falls near it. So July 17th. So it's something close to our hearts as well.
But your anniversary is not a day of mourning, I assume.
No, I was saying that ironically. Okay. So the other thing that we just brought up is that on this day, which it'll start Monday night, in the synagogue they read Lamentations, Echa. So this is what I want to look at this morning. And if you want to turn there. And Echa is written as a remembrance of what? Go ahead, Nick.
Exile.
But before the exile, the destruction.
Right.
Right? We'll look at Echa here in a second, but it's the destruction is the real focus. And to start, I want to get some background to Echa, to Lamentations. Turn to 2 Kings 24. And we'll start. Well, maybe what I'll do is I'll summarize the beginning of chapter 24. All the trouble starts during the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. First verse, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, comes to Jerusalem, and he basically makes Jehoiakim as a vassal, Evid, in the Hebrew here, vassal of the king Nebuchadnezzar. And who does Nebuchadnezzar use to attack Jerusalem with? The second verse of 2 Kings 24.
Bands of the Chaldeans, bands of the Syrians, bands of the Moabites, Ammonites.
Right. Okay. So it's not just Babylonians coming from Iraq. Where is Moab? Where is Ammon? Where is Aram, Syria? Where are they from?
We're down here.
They're from down here. They're basically neighbors. So keep that in mind. And according to 2 Kings, the Lord's done this because of the sins of which king?
Manasseh.
Yeah, Manasseh, right? Verse 3. And his sins are legendary in Kings. I believe Manasseh is where it talks about them sacrificing babies to Molech down in Ben Hinnom, gay Ben Hinnom. And all right. So verse 6 of 2 Kings, we come and Jehoiakim, he passes away, and who stands up in his place? Jehoiachin. Okay, and that's with a chaf. Jehoiakim is with a kuf. So Jehoiachin becomes the king. And he's 18 years old. He rules, and again, Nebuchadnezzar comes up to Jerusalem. And this time, Jehoiachin isn't really into a fight, and he also submits to Nebuchadnezzar. And so what happens when he submits to Nebuchadnezzar here? He gives up, if you look in verse 13, all the riches and the treasuries of the Lord's temple, the royal palace, the gold items. Verse 14, not only are these treasures going off from the temple, also, let's say, kind of the most important people of Jerusalem are going. You've got officials, soldiers, you've got Savim, Giboe, Chayil, craftsmen, people with skills are being taken off to Babylon. How many people?
10,000.
10,000.
It's a hell of a lot of people.
And the king. Right? Verse 15, the king is also taken, along with the king's mother, his wives, his eunuchs, and other high-ranking officials. Okay. Just for background, this time period is going... I mean, I know the Exodus and the 400 years of slavery in Egypt is a big deal in Jewish history. I know that coming into the land is a big deal. There's all of these challenges that Israel faces. But the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem and the Babylonian captivity is really kind of this watershed moment in Jewish history. Because before this, the people are known as Israel, the children of Israel, the sons of Israel, or of Judah. When they come back from Babylon, they start to become known as Jews. And there's this almost like a rebirth of identification. The people take on a new persona.
So they go as Israelites.
Yes. And then when you come to the book of Esther and you read about Esther, the people are no longer called Hebrews, Israelites, they're called Jews in the book of Esther, which, as we all know, is the Persian period, which is after the exile. And in a sense, that's just a semantic, that's just a name. But and Jew is coming from Judah, right? Because it was the kingdom of Judah that was last standing in Jerusalem. So, but there is something else I think that changes with them when they watch their temple be destroyed. It affects their whole view on the world and how God works. We'll talk about that later. But also the prophets. Think about the prophets in, you know, the Hebrew Bible. Who are your most significant prophets?
Well, God's Lamentations, Jeremiah, but also Isaiah.
So Jeremiah, Isaiah,
Ezekiel.
And for Christians, we have Daniel in there as well, even though he's considered a different type of genre. But if you look in like the Christian order of the books, they have Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel. And Isaiah is from the time of Hezekiah. He's earlier. But if you look at the other three guys, where are they born? Where do they grow up? And what are their most formative years?
In Babylon.
I mean, it's you're right. There, it's based around Babylon. Let's start with Jeremiah. He's from the land and
Anatot.
And how does his whole life is dealing with this whole Babylonian invasion, and he suffers for it.
But wait a minute, Jeremiah's born in Anatot. Does he see the invasion that's coming because of their disobedience? He's not actually part of the Babylon. He doesn't go to Babylon, does he?
He's in a cistern. He's in prison when the Babylonians take Jerusalem.
His cistern is here.
That's right.
Right.
And then the Babylonians take him captive, and they start taking him to Babylon. But then Nebuchadnezzar sends his guys to free him, says, you can do whatever you want, you're freed. He comes back to Jerusalem, but then he's kidnapped and taken to Egypt by the forces. So his prophecies all revolve around this period. Go to Ezekiel, the first chapter. Ezekiel, the first chapter, says, in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day, while I was among the exiles from the Kabar River, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the fifth of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim. So remember, he's the second one who got taken to Babylon. So apparently, Yechezkel, Ezekiel, maybe went into captivity with the king. He was part of those 10,000. The word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi. So Ezekiel is very much a part of what's happening here. And you have a similar thing with Daniel, right? Go to Daniel chapter 1. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, so this is the first one, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it, and the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. And these he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. And then the king ordered the chief of his court officials to bring some of the Israelites from the royal family and nobility to Babylon. So this whole event of the siege of Jerusalem, the destruction, really has a main core in the big prophets. And even in the minor prophets, this whole destruction of Jerusalem plays a big part in a lot of the different minor prophets as well. So let's go back to 2 Kings 24. To Jehoiakim being taken captive. So that's 2 Kings 24. And he's taking the treasures. He's taking all of these important people. And let's go down to verse 18. 2 Kings 24:18. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king. And he reigned in Jerusalem 11 years. His mother's name was Hamutal, daughter of Jeremiah. I don't think it's the prophet, but anyways. She was from Libna. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, just as Jehoiakim had done. It was because of the Lord's anger that all this happened to Jerusalem and Judah. And in the end, he thrust them from his presence. Now Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. So remember, Zedekiah has been put into place by Nebuchadnezzar. He's his hand-picked puppet king. But Zedekiah rebels against the Lord. So in the ninth year, so now we're in chapter 25 of 2 Kings. In the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, marched against Jerusalem with his whole army. And it's under siege. Go to verse 3. By the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine in the city had become so severe that there was no food for the people to eat. So keep this in mind. There's famine. Food is a really big issue. That's what a siege is supposed to do. It's supposed to starve the city. Verse 4, then the city wall was broken through, and the whole army fled at night through the gate between the two walls near the king's garden. Though the Babylonians were surrounding the city, they fled toward the Arava. But the Babylonian army pursued the king and overtook him in the plains of Yericho. Have you been to Ramat Rachel, to the king's palace there? They connect it to Uzziahu, the king who got the leprosy, and he had to go outside of Jerusalem because he was unclean, and that's where they think his palace was. And so,
could you just recap 1 second? You said chapter 25. I thought you said that Zedekiah rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, but I don't think that's right. I don't think I heard right.
He did, yeah, he did.
Oh, Zedekiah rebels against...
Yes, Nebuchadnezzar picked him, but then later on he rebels against Nebuchadnezzar.
And then Nebuchadnezzar comes against Jerusalem now.
A third time, yes.
Right. So it's like the punishment for Zedekiah is the siege of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar.
Yes, that's right. Anyways, Ramat Rachel, there's this palace there, Judean king's royal palace, and there is, I don't quite know the description of it, but there's like a tunnel that comes out of it underneath the walls, and the archaeologists there date it to this time period because it's going out towards the Arava as an escape ditch to get away from the Babylonians, maybe in the middle of the night. So you can see that if you go to Ramat Rachel, that maybe that's where the king's forces were before they made their last ditch effort to flee. So back to 2 Kings 25. It says that all of the Zedekiah's soldiers were separated from him. That's in verse 5. And they got scattered, and Zedekiah was captured. He was taken to the king of Babylon at Riblah, where sentence was pronounced on him. They killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and then they put out his eyes. So the last thing that Zedekiah sees is all of his sons being killed. And then they blind him. And they put him in bronze shackles, and they take him to Babylon. And this is where we get the idea of Tisha B'Av, where it doesn't actually say on the ninth day is when they destroyed Jerusalem, but the idea from rabbinic tradition is they looked at the seventh day is when they, on verse 8, on the seventh day of the fifth month is when they breached the walls or came to Jerusalem. And he set fire to the temple of the Lord, verse 9, and to the royal palace and all of the houses of Jerusalem. Every important building he burned down. And they broke down the walls around Jerusalem. And then they carried into exile the people who remained in the city. And so in the text, it talks about a seventh day and it talks about a tenth day. So the ninth day, Tisha B'Av, falls in there. That the fire was lit on the ninth day, even though it technically doesn't say it. This is according to the tradition.
Tradition is also muddled up with the 17th of Tammuz, which is when the walls were breached by the Romans.
Right.
And then somehow the ninth of Av falls the day that they actually take the city. So it looks like the two, in terms of date, Jewish dating, the two stories have got somewhat confused.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely right.
So, I mean, it sounds good because.
Because the 3 weeks, we're in the three weeks of, which is of fasting and no concerts and whatever now, which run from the 17th of Tammuz to the 9th of Av.
Yeah. So, so let's just bring this. I'm just giving some background to Lamentations to Echa. I just want to bring it together here and. Couple minutes. What happens in the rest of this chapter So Zedekiah has been blinded. His sons have been killed. He's been taken to captivity. They've taken all of, or most of, the temple treasures. If you look down in verse 13, 16, 17, and all of that. And the people. And how many people go into captivity this time? It's not as many as the first time. I think it's around 4,000. So it's in there somewhere. So, anyways.
Which year are we talking again now? What year?
The destruction? 586, 587. Depending on how you read it. Okay, so this is the background. So let's go to Echa. Lamentations. One of the interesting things about Echa is that it is a song. It's a, like a poem. And it is an acrostic, which it would be like taking the letters of the English alphabet and writing "all days are good because the sun comes up over the hill." And you take the letters of the alphabet and you build your poem off of the letters A, B, C, D, E, F. And in Yitzha, it's the same thing with the Hebrew alphabet. How many letters are in the Hebrew alphabet?
22.
22. How many are in English?
24.
24.
I thought it was 26.
Oh, 26. 26.
Oh, you're right.
26.
Okay. Yeah. So, if you look real quick, just flip through Lamentations, and look how many verses are in the chapters. There's five chapters. How many are in the first chapter?
22.
Second.
Yeah. Wow.
Third.
22.
66. 4.
22.
22 and 5.
22.
So what do you think happened in chapter 3?
Tripled.
Yeah. That's right. So chapter 3 is interesting because it starts off with, it does it triple, and it does it like a triple play where it goes Aleph, 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 Bet, 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 and so on.
But verse 22 is the one we know. It's that that's all the Lord never ceases.
That's right. And we'll get to that one. So,
chapter 3 is basically three alphabet, three.
Triple the pleasure.
Triple.
Triple letters. And one other discrepancy is chapter 5 is not an acrostic. So it doesn't follow the A, B, C, D thing. But it does have 22 verses. So it's like it wanted to be like the rest, but then it decided I'll be a little different. So
I have a lot of Hebrew Bible which clearly spells out the verses.
Breaks it out. Yeah,
I've got it here. Echa.
Okay, so that's the structure. Genre-wise, it's called a lament. And this is, in the ancient Near East, this is a common genre. It's a common theme when a city that's been defeated will cry over its destruction. And so the adverb echa is connected to this idea of lament.
Echa sounds like what we're
Sharon always says, it's, how come?
Yeah, so in English, how come, King James, alas, there's other ways I'm sure you could, but it's this idea of, I cannot believe it. This is crazy. How could this happen? What in the world? So the very first verse there. How deserted lies the city, once so full of people. How like a widow is she, who once was great among the nations. Another place where Echa is, if you look at Isaiah 1:21, see how the faithful city has become a harlot. You know, how has the faithful city, how has she become a harlot? So these are laments of, I cannot believe this terrible thing has happened. How could someone good become bad? How could someone so full of life become so dead? It's juxtapositioning the two extremes. Let's read a little bit to get a feel for everything. We don't have time to read every verse, but let's try to read a little bit from each chapter to get a feeling for the song. How deserted lies the city, once so full of people. How like a widow is she, who once was great among the nations. She who was queen among the provinces has now become a slave. Bitterly she weeps at night. Tears are upon her cheeks. Among all her lovers there is none to comfort her. All her friends have betrayed her. They have become her enemies. After affliction and harsh labor, Judah has gone into exile. She dwells among the nations. She finds no resting place. All who pursue her have overtaken her in the midst of her distress. The roads to Zion mourn, for no one comes to her appointed feast. All her gateways are desolate. Her priests groan, her maidens grieve, and she is in bitter anguish. Her foes have become her masters. Her enemies are at ease. The Lord has brought her grief because of her many sins. Her children have gone into exile, captive before the foe. All the splendor has departed from the daughter of Zion. This is one characteristic throughout this book. She's called Batzion. So not only is she a woman, but she has this title, Batzion. And you can find this in Isaiah quite a bit, Jeremiah, Micah, Zephaniah, that it's, this is another title for Yerushalayim, Batzion. Verse 7. In the days of her affliction and wandering, Jerusalem remembers all the treasures that were hers in days of old. What do you think those treasures would be that they would be remembering? What did we just read about in 2 Kings?
Well, the destruction of the temple. I mean,
right.
People and things.
Yeah. But there's, I think there's definitely some, there's a connection there to the temple. The word, you have Mahmad and also Mahmud. And we had a neighbor in Abu Ghosh called Mahmud, so I now see where his name comes from. But if you look at the way this word's used in the Bible, it's often connected to temple treasures.
Where is it in English?
Treasures. Verse 7, verse 10. Verse 10, it says, the enemy laid hands on all her treasures. She saw pagan nations enter her sanctuary.
Mahmud.
Hold on. Mem het.
Mem het.
David.
Mem.
Het. Mem. Dalit. So in verse 7, it's Mahmud. And but like in Isaiah 64, verse 11. Our holy and glorious temple, where our fathers praised you, has been burned with fire, and all that we treasured lies in ruins. So, same word here. That's Isaiah 64, 11. Ezekiel 24, 21. Say to the house of Israel, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am about to desecrate my sanctuary, the stronghold in which you take pride, the delight of your eyes, the object of your affection. The sons and daughters you left behind will fall by the sword. So the word there for affection Mahmad Inechem.
Is it when I have stronghold?
In which your eyes delight. Is the word there? But he's talking about desecrating the temple, the thing that you've made as your treasure. Joel 3:5, 2 Chronicles 36:19. So there's this idea that the treasures in the temple are these precious objects, but they also can be people, things that are precious objects. Obviously, it makes complete sense. In Ezekiel 24:16, when he's talking about, you think this about the temple, Ezekiel, your wife, she's going to die, right? That's his precious object. Hosea 9 talks about children being these precious objects. And later on in Lamentations, if you look at Lamentations chapter 2, Verse 4 says, like an enemy, the Lord has strung his bow. His right hand is ready. Like a foe, he has slain all who were pleasing to the eye. So it's that same term again. Those things that were precious to your eye, he's poured out his wrath. So what is he slain? He's slain something that's precious to your eyes. And basically, it's your children, because the children are always the most precious thing to any family, any civilization, because they're the next generation.
It's also, isn't it, that these things, whatever they are, whether it's the temple or the children or the wives or people even, they've all become more important, more treasured than God himself, because it's all about rebellion against God.
Sure, sure. Look at Lamentations 4. I love this imagery here, these first 6 or 7 verses, because it's been talking about all these treasures and jewels and things. And Lamentations 4, verse 1, how the gold has lost its luster, the fine gold became dull, the sacred gems are scattered at the head of every street. So when you first read this, you're thinking, okay, as they're looting the temple, they're kind of spilling their loot along the way. Keep reading. How the precious sons of Zion, once worth their weight in gold, are now considered as pots of clay, the work of a potter's hands. Oh, so the sons, the children, are these jewels. Even jackals offer their breast to nurse their young, but my people have become heartless like ostriches in the desert. Because of thirst, the infant's tongue sticks to the roof of its mouth. The children beg for bread, but no one gives it to them. Those who once ate delicacies are destitute in the streets. those nurtured in purple, who's nurtured in purple?
Kings.
Kings. So these are royal children, or at least associated to the household somehow. Now lie on ash heaps. The punishment of my people is greater than that of Sodom, which was overthrown in a moment without a hand turned to help her. Why is Sodom a better end than Jerusalem? Sodom happened like that. It's like getting on in a head-on collision. You die instantly.
Yeah.
How did Jerusalem die?
Over time,
starvation.
And with much more suffering.
Much more suffering. Their princes were brighter than snow and whiter than milk. Their bodies more ruddy than rubies. So here is again is that connection to the children being like jewels or treasures. Their appearance like sapphires. But now they are blacker than soot. Now they are not recognized in the streets, right? Their bodies have been so disfigured by bloating and...
starvation.
Well, what do you call it when the body's rotting?
Angry.
Yeah, there's something else too. Their skin is shriveled on their bones. It has become as dry as a stick. Those killed by the sword are better off than those who die of famine.
Which is again like...
Yeah.
Sodom.
Yeah. Racked with hunger, they waste away for lack of food from the field. With their own hands, compassionate women have cooked their own children, who became their food when my people were destroyed. Okay, so this is like a horror film. This is like an apocalypse. The person who's writing this was there. He saw this. These are like eyewitness accounts. If you were to go back to chapter 2, verse 11, he says, "My eyes fail from weeping. I am in torment within. My heart is poured out on the ground because my people are destroyed. Because children and infants faint in the streets of the city. They say to their mothers, 'Where is bread and wine?' as they faint like wounded men in the streets of the city, as their lives ebb away in their mother's arms. What can I say for you? With what can I compare you, O daughter of Zion? To what can I liken you that I may comfort you?" And if you come down to verse 19...
Chapter
2. "Arise, cry out in the night as the watches of the night begin. Pour out your heart like water in the presence of the Lord. Lift up your hands to him for the lives of your children who faint from hunger at the head of every street." If you read Lamentations, it's talking so much about children and children starving. It's really horrible. Verse 20. "Look, O Lord, consider, whom have you ever treated like this? Should women eat their offspring, the children they have cared for? Should priest and prophet be killed in the sanctuary of the Lord? Young and old lie together in the dust of the streets. My young men and maidens have fallen by the sword. You have slain them in the day of your anger. You have slaughtered them without pity." And this one in verse 22 is really poignant. "As you summon to a feast day, so you summoned against me terrors on every side. In the day of the Lord's anger, no one escaped or survived. Those I cared for and those who I raised or I reared, my enemy is destroyed." So it's real personal. Like, this is my daughter that I raised up. This is my son. This was my friend's kids. I was their godparent. I've seen them die. So this is very, very raw, and it's, you know, it's uncensored. So,
in the beginning of chapter 3, "I am the man who's seen affliction by the rod of the Lord's wrath."
Yes.
I mean, he's not blaming. This is the Lord's wrath that is doing this.
Yeah, it's complicated. Because on one hand, they've sinned, right?
Right.
That's said quite often in here. It's because of Jerusalem's sin this has happened. It's because of
their rebellion.
Of this. But then the writer also says, come on, God, stop. We've had enough. Go to verse chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 1. "Remember, O Lord, what has happened to us. Look and see our disgrace. Our inheritance has been turned over to aliens, our homes to foreigners. We have become orphans and fatherless. Our mothers are like widows. We must buy the water we drink. So it seems like here in chapter 5, this is a little bit later. There's some distance from chapter 2 and 3 where children are being eaten and people are starving to death. They're actually now getting water, but they're having to buy it. Who knows why? Our wood can only be had at a price. So there's some kind of black market going on now. It always happens, right? When there's a scarcity and people take advantage of a situation. Verse 5, those who pursue us are at our heels. We are weary and find no rest. We submitted to Egypt and Assyria to get enough bread. Right? Egypt is to the south, Assyria is to the north, Babylon is the one who crushed them. And so it looks like they're trying to work with Egypt and Assyria to survive. They're trying to trade. But, you know, to get enough bread. So they're depending on these local entities to help them. Now, this is what I'm trying to say to you, Gemma, about verse 7. This person says, our fathers sinned and are no more, and we bear their punishment. So it's kind of like, okay, our fathers sinned. We're the next generation. It's time to move on. Things need to change. And so...
to the third and fourth generation.
Yeah, it's... we can say... yeah, it's not fair. That's what the next generation is saying. You know, because our parents went into debt, why do I have to keep pay off their debts? But anyways, here, keep listening. Slaves rule over us, and there's none to free us from their hands. We get our bread at the risk of our lives because of the sword in the desert. So, for some reason, bread, it looks like it's coming from the desert through a trade route. I don't quite understand, because they should be able to grow it here, but maybe this is when things have been destroyed so badly, it's going to take a few years. Our skin is as hot as an oven, feverish from hunger. Women have been ravished in Zion, and virgins in the town of Judah. Princes have been hung up by their hands, and elders are shown no respect. Young men toil at the millstones, boys stagger under loads of wood. The elders are gone from the city gate, and young men have stopped their music. Yeah, there's no time for music when you got to work 20 hours a day, right? Joy is gone from our hearts, and our dancing has turned to mourning. The crown has fallen from our head. Now, this is interesting, the crown. If you look over in chapter 2, verse 3, he's talking about the Lord in his fierce anger has cut off every horn of Israel. What is the horn symbolic of?
And
strength and
authority, like a crown, I guess.
Yeah, and specifically sons of the king. There, it's where also the whole idea of the anointed one, the Messiah, is a horn. So like when you have your vision in Daniel with 10 horns grow out of the beast, each horn represents a new leader or ruler. And so here it says every horn has been cut off in Israel. So that makes me think of Zedekiah, where all of his sons were killed in front of him. And if you go back to chapter 4, Lamentations chapter 4, where is my verse? Okay, let me just find it. Verse 20. 4:20. The Lord's anointed, our very life breath, was caught in their traps. So, who is that probably talking about? Yeah, Zedekiah. He was caught. And so when we look back at chapter 5, and it says the crown has fallen off our heads, who's the last king of Judah? Zedekiah. Who's the next person who comes?
It's an ironic statement, too. He's not just saying our king, our fallen king, our corrupt, immoral king. He's saying, you know, the anointed of God.
Yeah.
Like, it's again, it's like, dig at, you know, come on, God. This is, you anointed this guy.
Yeah, because you made a promise to David that your son will always be on the throne in Jerusalem.
Yeah, like how could it be that the anointed of the God of the universe is being dragged away by his son?
So who comes next to rule in Jerusalem? Who's brought back under the Persians? Sorry? No, no, he doesn't come back. He stays in Babylon. Zerubbabel, right? He's the next, but he's not a king, right? Who is Zerubbabel? He comes with Ezra, right? He's related to the royal house, but he's not quite the same. I mean, because, you know, Zedekiah's, all of his sons were killed, and so... So that's kind of this whole story.
Don't we have a situation where there aren't any more kings?
Well, yeah, that's kind of the, I mean, the point.
That's the whole point, isn't it? That the last king is gone. They come back.
You have people who are related, you know, extended family. I'm not an expert in this, but from what I make out of it, especially when you come to Jesus' genealogy,
right,
when they're trying to say, look, Jesus comes from
David,
this line, this is how he comes, but it's like I might be related to George Washington, right? But it doesn't mean anything because I'm so not that we have a monarchy in America, but exactly, it doesn't show. But anyways, so back to chapter 5.
That's a compliment, Jordan.
So
that wasn't a compliment.
I don't know. I have no idea.
Okay, so here we come to the end, right? Chapter 5, verse 17, or verse 16. The crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us, for we have sinned. Because of this, our hearts are faint. Because of these things, our eyes grow dim. For Mount Zion, which lies desolate, has jackals prowling over it, or foxes. So this also makes me think that this is later. This isn't fresh from the destruction, because wild animals are not going to be where there's action going on. They come to places that are not happening, that are desolate.
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of babies lying around half dead and dead. They do quite well on that.
Not in chapter 5. It doesn't talk about dead babies.
No, it talks about jackals prowling around. So jackals are prowling around looking for food.
Yeah, okay, I mean, you could make that argument, but jackals are more scared of humans, too. So they're going to be where there are no human action, movement. You know, they're, unless you have a pack of wolves or something, you know, they're a little more brave. But I'm just trying to say that I think this shows even more that this is a little bit later. It's not just dead babies they're after, they're in an area that's lying desolate. Okay, so how does the book end? Verse 19. You, O Lord, you reign forever. Your throne endures from generation to generation. That is good orthodoxy. That is comforting. That reminds us, as we always say, God's on the throne, right? You reign. Next verse. Why do you always forget us? Why do you forsake us so long? Restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may return. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and are angry with us beyond measure. And so in the synagogues, what I've read is that they don't end the reading there, because that's a downer.
Right.
They've got to go back and read, I think it's verse 20 again. Where, sorry, not 20, 19 or 21, one of those positive verses. So, what do you feel about this ending here? What's happening when this person's writing this? What's the situation like?
His emotions are raw and there's no positive outlook on the horizon.
So, what are the facts on the ground at that time? What do you think it looks like here in Jerusalem?
Dismal.
That what?
Dismal. Pretty dismal here in Jerusalem.
It's dismal. Yeah.
We're restorest yourself, Lord, that we may return. Is that a physical return to the land, or is it a physical return to, or is it a return to the Lord?
I guess it could be both. I think if you follow what you just said, that this is obviously before Ezra and Zerubbabel return to the land.
Yeah.
But also, it's obviously also talking about spiritual return too, repenting of sin, because that's what he says here. You know, we have sinned. We have sinned, right? Verse 16. So there is this acknowledgement that we have to return to you in a spiritual way, but maybe it's also implying that one day a group will return.
Yeah, that. I think it is repentance, because he's saying return us to you, and then we will be returned like in the old days. So.
Right, but in the old days we lived here.
No, I know the being restored. In the old days, that's like a more physical, let us go back and live in our homes. But the return us to you, that sounds more like repentance. Like,
right.
Help us repent so that we can be physically restored.
Yeah. That there are no longer jackals running around the holy place.
I'm doing the parasha today, and I don't know if I want to say it now, but the core key is in the parasha, which is in the first chapter of Deuteronomy, when Israel says, you hate us and you want to destroy us. And that is a lie, because the whole of the verse has been a build-up. I have done this, I have done that, I will bring you out. You've just beaten Og and Bashan and the whole lot, the beginning of the chapter. I don't want to talk about it now, because I have to talk about it in a few minutes. But I think it's the clue to understanding so much of Echa is that we have sinned, and our sin was actually saying, God, you hate us, and you want to destroy us, because God has never said that.
You're saying that the people's attitude or idea of God is the sin.
It's what they say.
Right.
God has told them, I've done this, I've done that, now go up and take the hill of the Amorites, because it's part of the land that you're going to give them. They come down, two of them say it's great, and everybody else says it's got full of problems, it's going to be this and this and this and this and this, and they spell it out. They say, God, you have hated us. They really put a curse on themselves, and they open themselves up to the whole of the destruction. And I think that's the link with Echa, because it always comes that same verse, and it's exactly the same in Isaiah chapter 1.
So let's end with that idea that the sin is something that starts in the heart.
Yeah.
And it becomes an attitude, and it becomes...
And it gets spoken out, words
and it
power.
Gets spoken out, and it becomes put into flesh by going to Lamentations 3. So instead of ending with how the book ends, I want to end with, as David Bogarty pointed out, the verses that Christians know. The verses that we know from this book are found in the heart of this middle chapter here.
3:22.
Lamentations
3:22.
Well, I'm going to start a little earlier. Talks about how God is like smashing and hurting and destroying. For instance, in verse 16, he has broken my teeth with gravel. He has trampled me in the dust. I have been deprived of peace. I have forgotten what prosperity is. So I say, my splendor is gone and all that I hoped from the Lord. I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall. I well remember them. And my soul is downcast within me. And so this is kind of going on with what you're saying, that I'm scared. I don't want to enter the land. I see all the bad things that have happened in the past with certain things. And these things still are with me. And it affects my attitude. Verse 21. But here I think is the key to the whole book for those of us who want to survive in this world. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. For his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. So the point is, and I don't need to spell it out, is that no matter what is happening around us, is the writer here is saying, I've seen children being eaten by their mothers. I've seen all of these horrible things, but I choose not to remember that. I choose to focus on God's chesed, his faithful love, his compassion, and that no matter what happened yesterday, this morning I'm going to focus on the hope that I have in the Lord's faithfulness, and that, first off, that there is a God. Because people who've lived through stuff like this, it's easy to say there is no God, because a good God would never allow this to happen. And that's an easy path to go down. And then second, if there is a God, a lot of people will say, well, this is a cruel God. It's not a good God, and I will not follow this God. But the writer here is choosing to say, I don't understand why this has happened. I understand their sin, and I confess it, but I still don't understand why it keeps going on, the punishment and the suffering. And sometimes it's not even clear if someone sinned. And that actually, I think, is a bad question to ask all the time. Why did this happen? But it's the focus of how do you respond to what's happened?
Well, the baby that got eaten by its mother didn't sin.
Right.
I mean, it's interesting, too. Like, you know, like you're saying about the verses that Christians know. Like, we in our tradition don't have a tradition of reading portions of scripture like this.
Right.
You know, unlike in the synagogue. And if we do read it, it's so distant from us that it's like, oh, this is what happened to
those.
This is what happened to peoples who sinned and really went
yeah.
off. Like, we don't relate to this in any way, in any personal way. Whereas in the synagogue, you're supposed to read this as being, wow, this was us, and it could be us. And that's an important reminder. Like, this type of reality is closer. There's a potential for the reality that we live in turning into something like this at any time.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not just around the corner, but like.
But there's Aleppo. There are things in our modern world that do pop up that can have a feeling of some of these things.
Yeah, and there are believers in Aleppo who haven't sinned and yet they're suffering like this.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's amazing is that you know, unlike any other religion that I know of, like, not only are you allowed to, but it's even good, not just for catharsis, but to go ahead and express all of this.
Your feelings.
Yeah.
Like the Psalms.
Yeah. And it's a good, it's not just a welcoming practice, like God invites us to
share your heart.
In all of our like seething, bitter anger, you can stay engaged. Like, he doesn't, like, after a book like this, you know, any person, any king, any God, assuming they would say, you can't talk to me like that, you know.
Erase that.
You know, that is not respectful. You're finished. But he remains engaged even when you're in the pit, and you know, and maybe not everything is correct about your perspective about, you know, God, you hate us and you allowed this and, you know, we don't deserve this but it's just like, yeah, get all of that out. You know, it's important to be able to say that to God when you're feeling that way. And I think that's, like, we as Christians, when it starts to get rough and we don't understand it, we're not practiced in knowing how to go through hard times and being angry even and staying engaged. Like, you either know that God is with you and so everything will go well with you because you're good, or things are going wrong, so you must be one of the bad guys.
And that's even more horrible.
Yeah, but this is one of the good guys writing, and all of this horrible stuff happened.
Any other comments or before we close? Thoughts?
It seems like always the way how people react to their situation is that King David, when he was in Psalm 51, when he asked God, create my new heart in me, so put on his side, not on him.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a culture of repenting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just want to read that one verse there. In chapter 3, verse 24, in verse 25, I say to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for him. The Lord is good to those whose hope is in him, to the one who seeks him. So this morning, I think Echa, it is a... It's a book of questions and not of answers, but I think it also is a book of hope and of seeking the right attitude. And so just, I think also of keeping us humble, especially when there are people around us who are really suffering. I've never really suffered in my life, but for those who have really gone through things that are unbelievable, that, you know, they've experienced something that is unique and just something that's, you almost can't put into words of what they've been through. And to put our focus on that, the hope rather than the tragedy, is I think
we
key.
Have a responsibility as born again believers to hold that hope for Israel, which has been through the Shoah in the lifetime of so many. Which is really not so unlike much of this.
Correct.
And their question, Israel's question, is often, where was God in the Holocaust? And if God is really so good, why did he let it happen? I mean, those are banal questions that is asked by many survivors, as well as people close. And I think we have a responsibility to saying that out of this appalling situation, whether it was brought in by the sin of man or whether it was brought in by an act of God, we have to trust God, because he has made it clear he loves us. He has brought us out. He will deliver us. Every message all the way through is, I will bring you out.
Mm-hmm.
I will deliver you. I will free you. I will give you living water. And that's the message that we have to convey.
Mm-hmm. God's love, that chesed.
It's God's chesed, but we don't cheapen it by sort of how God is loved.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
But the reason why we have hope is because of that love.
It's because of him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.